From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour. I'm Tom Sherwood, sitting in for Kojo Namdi. WAMU reporter Martin Ostermeier is our guest analyst today. Martin, welcome to that seat.
I'm honored to play Tom Sherwood today.
Just interrupt the guests regularly and you'll be good. And we're going to get to our guest in just a moment. But Martin, let's start in Virginia with Barbara Comstock.
Barbara Comstock, yeah. So she represents the 10th District in Congress. It's the part of Virginia that stretches from the D.C. suburbs out towards the West Virginia line, incorporates parts of Loudoun County and whatnot. And obviously, she's one of the more vulnerable Republicans in Northern Virginia at this point. Well, one of the few, honestly, Republicans representing Northern Virginia these days. And after last year's elections, statewide elections, clearly vulnerable. And now there are seven Democrats who say they would like to replace her in Congress.
They had their first forum this past week.
Exactly.
They sounded like a lot of Me Toos.
Yeah, and it's obviously an interesting challenge for them that obviously Comstock is vulnerable given what happened in the statewide elections last year with Democrats gaining a lot of seats in Richmond. But then there's always that balance that they have to play. You know, do they go full Democratic? Do they go as progressive as possible? Or do they have to kind of moderate their positions a little bit, knowing full well that not everybody in the 10th district is going to be as progressive as they are necessarily? I mean, look, they may not like Donald Trump. They may not have liked Ed Gillespie, but it doesn't mean they're going to love a Democrat instead of Barbara Comstock.
She's a moderate conservative. She's actually from the old wing of the establishment Republicans. She's tried to walk a fine line of not embracing Trump any more than she has to. And a lot of people like that about her in that the Republicans in that county,
right,
district.
And of course, the sort of politics that you're seeing play out in the 10th district are playing out, you know, nationwide when it comes to Democrats. There's that fight. There's always been a fight, and more so now, I think, than before, between the progressive wing of the party and the more establishment wing of the party. Like, how far do you go in pushing certain positions? And of course, now it feels like a lot of Democrats are saying, well, this is our moment to be as progressive as possible, given the way Virginia went last year. But again, you run a risk that you may still alienate those middle-of-the-road independent voters that aren't that progressive.
And we'll see. No doubt President Trump would make some news between now and the November elections, which could help or hurt her, but we'll see. Joining us now in the studio is David Grosso. He's an at-large member of the D.C. Council, and more importantly for this discussion, the chair of the Education Committee. Mr. Councilmember, welcome.
Well, good afternoon, Tom. Martin, it's good to be here with you guys.
Do we have to call you chairman since you're the chairman of the Education Committee?
Call me David, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, let's start with an easy question first. When and how did you learn that the chancellor, Antoine Wilson, was out of a job?
Well, the way it worked out is on Thursday evening, the chancellor reached out to me and asked to sit down and talk to me about something personal and important. And so we, of course, immediately made time on Friday to sit down with him last week and did that. And so it was last Friday.
So last Friday is when he actually told you, listen, this has come up with my kid that, you know, my daughter got transferred from a school that she had been attending to another school.
Right. Prior to that, I had no knowledge where his, you know, daughter, I thought she was still at Duke Ellington, to be honest with you. But that was when he told me the whole circumstance and what was happening.
And then the mayor found out from the inspector general's office. They called and let her know, and she was furious. I mean, and also dumbstruck, and said it's inexplicable. We'd already been through a school assignment placement controversy with Kaya Henderson and some of the mayor's senior staff. Have you talked to former Deputy Mayor Niles, Jenny Niles, who also had to resign in this mess? Why in the world did she agree to have the chancellor's child be moved from school? I know the chancellor, in part, was fully acting as a worried parent, and so was his wife. They were very concerned about their sophomore daughter. But why didn't the deputy mayor, have you actually spoken to Niles and said, I mean, what the hell were you doing?
I have not actually had a chance to speak with her, and I look forward to talking to her, but it is a good question, and I think that's what the mayor was asking her and why she ultimately had to resign. You know, if in this situation they had simply just asked for help more broadly than just in a cocoon like they were doing it, they might have come up with better options to actually support the chancellor's daughter. And that
could have gotten
happen.
A tutor. They could. She could have taken maybe a, you know, if she was having so much trouble at the school, some step out of the school for a short time and reconsider and follow some rules.
There was a lot of other ways that they could have handled it, and they handled it poorly. And I think everyone understands that.
But politically, I'm just stunned. I mean, I will ask Niles if I ever get to see her in town. How could she not see that this would be a terrible thing for Mayor Bowser? You're already dealing, as Martin knows a great deal about, the school system already is reeling. All the reform efforts are reeling because of the graduation and grade scandal. This is just too much.
I couldn't agree more.
So, but kind of going back to last Friday, so obviously the news comes out middle of the afternoon. It's a long weekend, which, you know, from a news perspective, looks like a perfect time to dump the news. And I think Trump was there was big news otherwise nationally. So it was like the perfect time to get the news out there. But at the same time, there was still kind of this swell of anger, of frustration, of surprise. There was a lot of council members who reported getting more calls than they've gotten and emails than they've gotten on a lot of issues. I know I spoke to council member Allen. He said, you know, he wasn't first out of the gate calling for a resignation, but he did. I think it was Sunday maybe that he actually put out a statement
right.
saying that he wanted Wilson to resign. And he said it was just based on the reaction he was hearing from parents. Now, you didn't go as far as some of your colleagues in calling for the resignation. Number one, why didn't you initially call for his resignation? And you know, also maybe why didn't your opinion change the way that it did for other council members?
For being the chair of the committee, I thought it was important for me to take a bigger view of this and to try really hard to understand the impact across the city, across the district, and what this would do to the education system and, you know, really try to understand that and be deliberate about it. And you know, frankly, I just felt like I had a different role to play that was one of more deliberation and thought. And I, of course, also received emails. I received tweets at me and other things. And that was all part of my deliberation. And mm-hmm. The other thing I think is important to note is that I was in communication with the mayor. Not all of this happens in public view.
Right.
And for sometimes good reason.
Yes, that's why we have the politics hour. What did the mayor call you up?
Is this the politics hour?
Yes, it is. Don't forget that. Yeah, so the mayor called you up and said, this is she clearly tried to letting the deputy mayor resign. She thought mm-hmm. maybe that would be a firewall for the chancellor to stay. But then she told Peter Jameson at the Post, this will be hour to hour. The chancellor's future is hour to hour. And it wasn't many more hours before he left. Why did you think he could survive it?
Well,
given the previous, if this had been the first scandal about school placement, that would have been one thing, or first abuse of the rules. But he helped write the rules, and then 3 months later, he goes circumvents the rules.
Tom, it's not about being a question of whether or not he could or couldn't survive. And I think that is unfortunately where we've ended up as the question. The question for me was, how can I still be, as the chair of this committee, supportive of everybody that's in that agency, of the other agencies that I work with on a regular basis, to make sure that they understand all the implications and the downstream impact of him having to resign? And the fact is that, you know, in the end, he didn't have a choice. That's where it came down, and that's where we have to deal with. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we're in a better position when it comes to the city's education efforts. So I don't want the public to think that just because we've gotten him out of that position that we're all of a sudden going to be able to fix the schools and make everything great. It's going to take time.
Yeah, but aren't you in danger of sounding like the bureaucracy yourself by saying the time issue? I mean, it was Kathy Patterson who told the Washington City paper on Saturday, there are children out there, for God's sakes. Direct quote from her. How can the chancellor have cheated on, and I'm not sure why you couldn't, as chairman of the committee said, this is a horrific blow to our.
Well, Tom, let's just be clear. I did say that
you did?
On Friday.
Yes.
I put out a statement saying how incredibly disappointing this was. And,
right.
And you know, I'm
and you supported Niles losing her job.
And I said that we were going to continue to investigate this issue and try to do what was right by the whole city.
But
I think that's a difference than just a very quick, almost knee-jerk reaction of saying, they got to get rid of this guy. How about we be a little bit more deliberate? And frankly, you know, I think I have a higher responsibility as the chair of the committee to do that, and that's what I tried to do. And
to be fair, I mean, you were the chairman Mendelson.
This is the politics hour. You don't have to be fair.
Or this is true. I'll do my best Tom Sherwood in a second. But first of all, Chairman Mendelson also didn't call for his resignation. I mean, there were members of the council, including Trayon White, to begin with, who said, listen, it's not, you know, there are other things that he's done well. Maybe I'm disappointed, but it doesn't mean I have to call on him to resign. But still, you know, over the weekend, there's this kind of chorus of people saying he should resign. Then come Monday, he does a round of media appearances, you know, TV, print, radio. To your understanding, when did it become really, really obvious that this wasn't tenable, he wasn't going to survive? Obviously, Tuesday morning, you sat down with the mayor. Was it, at that point, was it very clear that his fate was written?
Absolutely. And I think also the fact that I was able to take into consideration a few days of public input, which was important, rather than a few hours, mm-hmm. which I think it's not very well thought out when you do such a quick reaction. And then also speaking to my colleagues, you know, and hearing from my colleagues and, you know, being the lead on education, that was important to me. Let's just be clear, on Sunday evening, even Monday morning, there was not a majority in the Committee on Education that he should resign.
Right.
Okay, so let's not just jump to conclusions here. That's my responsibility. And when we did sit down on Tuesday morning with the mayor, it had become clear that that was necessary. And the mayor had to make that decision, but the chairman and I were able to sit down with her and walk her through kind of what we thought were the implications of doing that. And, you know, really, folks, let's talk about time. You know, it was Friday to Tuesday. I mean, this is not, you know, 1 month to another month or 6 months later.
It was Sunday.
We handled this very quickly. And now, unfortunately, now we have a situation where I'm going to have to start from scratch with new interim chancellor, a whole new search, an interim deputy mayor, a whole new search for that. And, you know, that makes it very hard for me, not just because of continuity, but also because of accountability. You know, it's very – I have a hearing next week, Tom, where the chancellor was supposed to come before me and be held accountable for the last year's school results, all the attendance, graduation, all that.
Will he still come now that he's out?
No. Maybe we can get Chancellor Henderson to come back.
Maybe he can explain.
I mean, come on.
Even he was a desperate parent, but I just – for all those bureaucratic reasons, I don't mean bureaucratic in the bad way, but just you have to look at the whole pie, and I know that you understand that.
And in fact, I think we did, and I think we came to the right conclusion. I think it's important that he stepped down, and I think we can move forward, and I'm not trying to be incredibly negative about this. We have a system in place that will survive and do well, and we're going to continue with our reforms, and I think Dr. Alexander, the interim chancellor,
we'll
is a good
choice.
We'll
get to her in just a moment. Because the people came out, Robert White, the at-large council member, was the first council member of seven or eight who ended up saying, this cannot stand. Marnie thought, as a person who's been around the city for a lot, is that I didn't see, as soon as I heard this story, when Mark Seagrace from NBC4 called me, said he was about to break this news, and I thought, how can he possibly stay in the job, the chancellor stay in the job, mm-hmm. when he's violated this very system? I mean, it doesn't seem to me you just have to start with a new because you don't have any choice. What would have been the choice? How could he have stayed? I just don't understand that delay. And then we'll get on to the interim chancellor. He couldn't appear before your committee and talk about the ethics and tell go to schools and tell students to do the right thing and follow the rules.
Let me reflect on that for a second. I think it's an important question.
You
know, the reality is that what he did was wrong, and he's admitted that what he did was wrong. And I also think that he was a subject a bit to the timing of what happened. We had just gone through this. We had rewritten the policy. He was a part of that, and that made it even more egregious. And I think there was a problem there. At the same time, I was at a meeting last week at Ballou High School with Councilmember Tryon White and with the chancellor. And, in fact, Councilmember Robert White was there, too. And when you saw the over 100 of people that were in that auditorium interacting with him and working with him, and then you go through the checklist of all the things you want for a chancellor. But let me finish. You go through a checklist of what you want in a chancellor. Obviously what he did was wrong and a mistake. But when you look at all the qualifications that he was bringing to the table and the fact that he was showing that kind of respect to the communities that I think deserve a ton of help right now and deserve a lot of attention, that made it, I think, not such a straightforward, easy, split-second decision. And frankly, my colleagues can make the decisions that they want to make, and that's fair. But when you're in the position that I'm in, it's important for me to be more deliberative about it and thoughtful and about the impact on the whole district. And that is, in fact, when I talked to the mayor last Friday, that is what she was also referring to, is how do we be very intentional and deliberate about what the next steps are here. And I think that's fair to give a few days to have that conversation and to have that thought. And let me just tell you, it was not a consensus in this city that he should go. And I think that's very clear from the emails I got, from the tweets I got, from all the input I got. We put out a release on Tuesday when he left. The number one email I got back from people was he shouldn't have gone.
Well, given this, the larger scandal, is the grades and graduation scandal, which everyone's trying to wrestle. I mean, it's a huge issue. It's too many people have graduated.
But do you know when that happened? Let me just be clear when that happened. That scandal started and happened mostly under an interim chancellor. So do you want to go back to that and have
no,
the
I'm
same
just
thing
saying,
happen
with
again?
That on the table already, then you have the chancellor who, as
I
a
agree.
Desperate
I
parent,
agree.
He and his wife, desperate parents for their sophomore child, I understand that, circumvented the rules. I just don't see how you can conceivably see that that person gets to lead the school reform effort no matter how qualified. It's like a 100-yard dash.
I just think you
might
have to realize
be doing
that
great,
is more
but if you,
to that
if
conversation
your toes
than
over,
just that decision. Just that decision
that
is an
decision
easy
is
one.
Not worth firing him just on its face.
Well, I think it's obvious that it has been. But the point is that there's more to it than that.
All right. We have an email person who says, where was the oversight? You didn't know about this. As you said, you thought the chancellor's child was still at Duke Ellington.
And you am don't I supposed even, to do an investigation?
Well, not an investigation, but why didn't the mayor Niles, Deputy Mayor Niles, and the chancellor let you know? Why didn't they let the mayor know?
Great question.
They
should have. And if they had, they would have come up with a better
solution. I mean, that goes to Martin, jump in this. I don't want to give a speech about this. I'm just, as a reporter at the mayor's news conference this week, you were there. I asked her, I said, Mayor, it's inexplicable that you could have the deputy mayor not stop this.
Right.
And she said it is inexplicable, and she hung her head. I mean, this is a bad hit on the mayor, too.
Couldn't agree more.
Martin?
I mean, the toughest thing about it is, and I got a chance to talk to now former Chancellor Wilson when he was doing his rounds of kind of media appearances on this Monday, you know, kind of in effect trying to, you know, explain his side of the story and also save his job to a certain extent. And, you know, he was giving as much as he felt comfortable giving about the internal dynamics of what was happening with his daughter and what went on in Duke Ellington. And you can tell, as a parent, I looked at him and I was like, listen, I'm a parent too. I understand you're struggling. And every parent in the city goes through this and understands that you will do anything for your kid. But I think what ended up catching him up, and this is what a lot of parents, not every parent, but a lot of people, parents found unforgivable. It's like, if I'm a normal parent and I'm stuck in my school and my kid is suffering, my options are limited. Sure, I mean, I could like opt for charter, which he couldn't do, or I could opt for private, which he probably also couldn't do.
I think they would have told the mayor if they thought it was a good idea, but we have an email.
I also think that he could have. The question that we should be asking ourselves is why isn't Dunbar High School up to the standards that the chancellor can send his child there, and that we need to understand why there aren't supports in the schools where his daughter were going to support her meaningfully so that she could actually be successful in that school, too.
If I were running for mayor, I'd stand in front of Dunbar and say, I'll make all the schools suitable and not just Wilson. But
well, if we could do that overnight, we would have already done it. It's not that easy.
But again, that's not easy is a difficult answer when you have these immediate things in front of you, and particularly when people are – it's not just that they did it. If they were not honest about it, they should have – you should have been told about this. The mayor should have been told. Another emailer says – why couldn't we be compassionate? He's done some good things, Mr. Wilson. Why couldn't we be more compassionate towards his decision? He admitted wrongdoing. Why isn't that enough? I think I've said it, but you want to say it again? Why isn't?
I mean, I think the email
trust
speaks
is
for
the
itself.
Main thing. All right.
And look, to be fair, again, I did just as every reporter does. I reached out to people in the community, both parents, elected officials, and you name it. Generally speaking, amongst the elected officials, I heard more along the lines of he should resign, parents also. But I definitely talked to parents who were like, listen, at that position, and they floated this idea, which I thought was interesting, and I'll run it by you, Chairman. Or sorry, council member, chairman,
David.
Okay.
Should a position like the chancellor, an executive at that level, should they be able to send their kid to any school in the system? Given again that, you know, they're flying in from across the country, they're relocating the entire family. Should he have been given this chance to just pick and choose?
This is too late to have that conversation.
No,
they should have had that conversation last year. No,
exactly. We want to get to the interim chancellor, what you know about her and what you think she'll be doing. But let's hear from a caller here. You have a moment. Go ahead. Should have stayed.
I think he should have stayed. He has finally learned what the school district business is all about. I'm a parent that had a child that had a lot of difficulties in school. So I'm speaking from experience. I think that what they should do now is to follow these students from Ballou that graduated and maybe weren't qualified. See if they go to college. Help them to it.
Well, the mayor has said that she will do that. The mayor has said that she will reach out to those students and parents and try to help them with any remedial work or whatever they need that would be doing. But Mr. Wilson was the leader of the school system. He circumvented the rules in a blatant way. Isn't that disqualifying?
No. I think what he should have said is that he should have promised that he would treat every school student in the district as his own child. He would take every care and make sure that the system worked for them, too.
Well, that's aspirational. What about that? But it's aspirational to want to treat everybody equally. But, of course, if children come from all manners of socioeconomic issues.
But let's not kid ourselves. I mean, the lottery, I think, is a good system. It's working better than it ever has, but it's not perfect. And, you know, people that have the resources can move to the jurisdiction, the areas in the city where they can choose a school that they want to go to. Mm-hmm. The chancellor couldn't do that because, frankly, he was locked into doing one thing. So
this is the politics hour. There's a caller number 5, who says, given the teacher turnover and the principal turnover and the other issues, why is David Grosso still the chairman of the education committee? Are you glad you have this job?
I think this is the most important work that I can be doing, and I think that it's also not as simple as people make it out to be, and we're doing our best to try to turn it around. And I'll note that this is not ending. You know, we asked the mayor just this week to deepen her investigation into the attendance and grade promotion issue. So we're asking her to actually do an investigation with Alvarez and Marsal to expand it so that you include charter high schools as well as charter and DCPS middle and elementary schools to better understand the root of the problem, and I think there's value in doing that type of investigation.
Caller number 5, if you're still there, was that a good answer?
That was a good answer, but when you look at the budgeting problems, the numbers with the school modernization budget, and the numbers that the school system had been putting out for years in regard to the increase in graduation, it was clear to anyone with a calculator that there was corruption. And Councilmember Grosso missed it, so he can stay on the committee, but he shouldn't be the chair.
Well, you know, I appreciate that. And, you know, the fact is that I actually introduced legislation that passed into law to change the way that we do funding of modernization projects because I'm trying to find more transparency. The fact is that, you know, the mayor simply has not followed the law in this issue. So we can, take them and push them around and have hearings. And I think, you know, if you look at my record and you look at the amount of oversight that I do, it actually has had a big impact. The Office of the State Superintendent of Education is operating better than it has in years. Partly because I have a good relationship with the superintendent, but also because I push her and hold her accountable and have hearings. And I think people will be surprised by how much effort and work that my staff and I put into oversight and making sure that the schools are operating the best we can. It's just, I think, a misnomer to think that we can turn this around as quickly as people would hope. And my hope is that we can keep moving it forward now in spite of the fact that we're in an interim status.
That's the broad picture. Caller 6, I think, just disappeared. Disappeared. The caller 6 says that all of these things about getting things done and working together and bringing people together and having new ideas. What about ethics? How can you be a leader if you're not ethical and circumventing the basic rule of how kids are placed in the schools is an ethical issue?
Well, I think that's very relevant and it's something that But let's just be clear. The pressure he had as a parent is different than what the deputy mayor did, and I think that's what the distinction was important to note.
All right, let's talk about the interim chancellor, Amanda Alexander. She's been the deputy chancellor in charge of elementary schools. She's been a candidate for the chancellor's job in the past. She spoke briefly this week. Martin, what were your thoughts as you saw her?
Well, the one thing that I asked you this after the conference, after the press conference where they announced the chancellor's resignation was, of course, the mayor did what she was going to do in that situation. She announces, listen, we're going to cast a national net. We're going to do a national search to find ourselves a new chancellor, just like they did with Chancellor Wilson. And, you know, every city does this, and D.C. did it with the police chief. They've done it for chancellors before. And I've always asked myself, I'm like, this is great and good because you want to get the best person for the job. And that means looking for the best person regardless of where they live. But I've always thought, like, when does it come to the point, and it seemed like they did with the police department, where they're like, okay, you know, we can cast a national search, we can go through that process, but we also want to give a little credit to people who are in working within the system and could, you know, bring that talent up through the ranks. Now, again, people have pushed back and said, no, we need a change agent. We need someone with no connections to D.C., like another Michelle Rhee type figure to come in and clean house and that sort of stuff. But there's always a downside because look what happened to Michelle Rhee. So like, how do you balance those two things of trying to find the right person for the job, someone who can come in and be that change agent, but also recognizing that there are folks who are working and have worked in the system for a long time who could step up to that job.
Good.
I think blowing it up and starting over again is not an appropriate response to this situation. I think that part of the challenge here is that we've gotten some good reforms in place that are now unveiling and revealing the challenges that really exist. And we got past the easy things, you know, past all the things that, you know, opening the schools on time, making sure there are books there, paying the teachers regularly,
buildings,
having a contract with the teachers. You get past all that, then what happens is you dig a little deeper and it gives you the opportunity to do that. You find out what are real issues in our city. This question about student attendance and graduating without all the qualifications, this is not anything new in the district. We've been struggling with these questions for 30 years, 40 years.
But the numbers are on it now.
Well, that's the thing. We have the information.
The numbers,
so now
yes,
we know.
It's
now
terrible.
We know.
And the student...
so we can do something about it, which is now's the time.
Let's hear from Tricia in Washington, who says she doesn't buy your answer. We're talking about collateral damage, that being children. Tricia, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Did I say your name correctly, Tricia?
You did, sir.
Okay, thank you. Do you have a quick question to Mr. Grasso or comment?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sitting here thinking this is a nation's capital, and you're talking about, you know, children getting to school on time and the chancellor cheating, and I have a daughter with special needs who's in the system, and I can't even get, you know, a school official to call me back. It's a total nightmare, and this is a nation's capital, and I just wonder how you justify any of this to yourself, to your children, to these constituents, and why, you know... As you said, this is a problem that's been going on for 30 years. What does it take to bring about change?
Mr. Grasso?
I think that's the best question that we've had today, and that is the challenge that we have before us. I believe that change comes about when we insist for better mental health services in the schools, we insist for better accountability for teachers, when we insist that we have a standard curriculum in the schools. And we can go through the long list, but it's not there yet, and so it's hard to convince people that it's actually happening. I visit all the schools. I engage with all these agencies, and I can tell you that there is change happening. It's just not happening fast enough, and I'm committed to making it happen.
People
faster.
Want change, but you know we're heading towards the end of the school year. The mayor said Amanda Alexander will be the interim chancellor at least through the end of the school year. But how do we know the people who are graduating or completing their courses? I mean, we were heading to the end of the school year. We don't know what's happening.
Well,
with the students.
The chancellor, the former chancellor, and the current interim chancellor has agreed to continue this work, is actually doing a transcript review process for every single graduating senior to make sure that they've met all their qualifications, both from an attendance perspective as well as a course credit perspective. And he even mentioned the other day at Ballou that there's going to be more students that are held over in the summer this year than ever before because of the fact that he's going to be basing this in real numbers.
And if they get help, that'd be a good thing. I just wrap this part up unless Martin has another avenue on it. It's just having the Kaia Henderson issue where she gave preferential treatment to some mayor's staff for their assignment. For this to have happened, it's just inexplicable, and it's hard to go forward when people... We can't explain how we got here.
Well, we're going forward, Tom.
Okay. What about guns? Let's talk about the President Trump. I know you're you're a big fan of his. He has suggested
don't slander my name. Like that.
He suggested this week that
I think Tom is trying to get to the question: do you think
guns.
Teachers should have guns?
Yes.
I think it's a huge mistake. I think science has shown us that having more guns around doesn't help the problem. It only makes matters worse. And I think that's true. I also really appreciate Congresswoman Norton calling for a withdrawal of the legislation that would allow concealed carry across jurisdictional lines. That's a huge mistake as well.
What you know, schools are, you know, they have locked doors. They have school resource officers, which really called a police officer. Mm-hmm. But you know, we live in an open society. If someone is crazed and has access to weapons, you know, the NRA says, you know, it's not a problem with people with guns. It's that the good people don't have guns. And if we would just ensure the schools are treated like maybe like prisons and lock them up in there.
But the good thing that came out of this was that this kind of town hall sit down sort of thing that the president had a couple days at the White House.
Yeah.
One of the people in there was actually a teacher at a D.C. charter school at Friendship over in Southeast D.C. in Ward 8. And he got called on and he got a chance to share his own experiences. And he was not about guns in schools. He was fine with security because a lot of D.C. schools already have security. But he was saying the one thing that their school does, which is really interesting, is the security guards. Sure, they're there to make sure you don't get a gun in or a knife in or a weapon. But they're also kind of doing like a mental check-in on all the students. And they're saying, if I notice a student comes in and they seem off, that's the first line of defense. And you can tell the front office, you can tell a teacher, that's listen, right. This student doesn't seem like they're okay today. Let's just keep an eye out. And I thought that was a really interesting perspective that got lost in the broader conversation of just whether teachers should have guns or not.
Well, the question also relates to that, which is really important, is that how well are we providing the mental health supports in our schools mm-hmm. for our teachers, for our students? We have a mental health task force right now for school-based mental health services. It's going to come out with a recommendation by the end of this month that is actually going to give us the direction in the budget for how we expand the number of professionals in the schools working with students. This young adult that did this horrible tragedy down in Florida, was expelled from school for his misbehavior and for his actions. That might have been the right thing to do, but the thing is that bothers me is that there wasn't somebody that was then taking care, to go reach out to him and figure out what it was that was really bothering him to stop him from doing this. Now, and we can't stop every incident like this, but for goodness sake, let's take a different approach than we have in the past. And I think more guns flying around in our community is not the solution.
We have a caller, number one, who wants to ask about safety in charter schools, because we have a lot of charter schools. I think half the student population in the city now mm-hmm. are students in charter schools, and they're less regulated, which is the whole point of being a charter. And so let's hear from the caller, Jennifer.
Hi, Councilmember Grasso. My children attend a charter school in D.C. I have three of them. And we had a serious safety issue in our school, actually, with a sexual abuser. And we went to the public charter school board to ask them what we could do about the situation, and they basically told us nothing, that they could do nothing, that it was not in their purview.
Oh, Mr. Councilmember?
That clearly is not the right answer. And the fact of the matter is, when it comes to the safety of students, not only does the public charter school board have an obligation to engage, but so does the city generally. So when you have an issue like that, I ask people to give me a call, let my committee know, and we'll help you figure out and investigate it. There should be, in my mind, at the forefront of everybody's thoughts should be the safety of the children when they come to school. And that includes, I think, lots of different ways that we can do that. But in that scenario, that was the wrong answer. You should
and
not have gotten that answer.
I mean, I
you're
don't,
a parent, Martin.
I am a parent, and I have a kid at a charter school. Now, I think the caller, I'm going to guess, may have been referring to Latin American Montessori Bilingual, LAMB, which had a teacher that was caught last year and had actually abused some children. And now in the aftermath of the investigation, they had found that there were some warning signs there, and the leadership of the school has had to leave. There's a $20 million lawsuit. I mean, these are serious issues. Of course, none of this after the fact is going to make parents feel happier or more satisfied with the response. They're going to say, why did that ever happen to begin with? But again, it's out of crises that you start that you kind of draw up ways to prevent them in the future. Were there warning signs that they missed? Were there things that the city or the school board could have done? And those are, again, none of this makes any parent feel good because things already happened.
But as we know, schools are reflective of our whole society, both the good and the bad.
Mm-hmm.
But I just, I don't understand why people talk about hardening the school so that people can't get in, teaching teachers how to shoot guns, when it seems to me the root issue is the gun itself and the availability in this country of having an AR-15, or why do you have those guns in a normal society? You want to have a gun out in the wilderness of Wyoming? Maybe we can have some special rules, but I just don't quite get it. Mr. Grasso, on that, I have one more quick question before you go.
Fairly insane, if you ask me.
Okay, another bubbling issue in the city is health care, and certainly east of the Anacostia River. The United Medical Center is going to go to court in order to not disclose information about its decision-making. I'm not sure, the mayor hasn't just called over and said, what the hell are you doing? But what's happening over there? The board, they closed their obstetrics center, and now there's some question about how they did it and why they did it and who did it and the reasons why they did it, and they don't want to disclose their records. They say they don't keep their records. Sounds like a violation. You're on the health committee. Your final words here on what can we do to get that place straightened out?
I just am so frustrated by it. It seems like it's just one stumble after the next over there, and this is another one where, these folks do not need to do work in secret. It's inappropriate to do that. We have lots and lots of public dollars that are going into UMC to try to make it successful. It therefore should be accountable to the public at large. I really appreciated my colleague, Councilmember Allen, who sent a letter over to UMC and said, you have to be directly responsive to the Office of Open Government, which is under his purview. And for them to say they're going to take him to court is really ridiculous. They do not have standing to do that. They need to be compliant. And to have secret meetings is something that I'm directly opposed to, and they need to be out in the open.
The board chairman is a former D.C. council member, LaRubie May, appointed by Mayor Bowser. I don't know why she wants to bring more grief to the mayor who has enough grief with the school system.
But
as a member, can you just call up LaRubie May and say, why don't you just release the information, no matter how embarrassing it might be?
Well, Vincent Gray has done a very good job trying to bring this out in hearings and in letters and in phone calls.
Go ahead and say I understand there are times that you want to stand on principle and say, no, I believe in this, so I'm going to take it to court, I'm going to fight it out. But this is the sort of thing. This is open government. This is decision making that should be made in the public. Like, fighting it just makes it seem like you have something to hide. And all that does is spur more curiosity. It's going to spur reporters like Pete Jameson from The Post, who's done great reporting on this, to keep digging further. It's going to keep people in the system itself who are frustrated. They're going to want to leak out information. I mean, you're not going to stem the flow. You just have to address the problems head on and just be honest about
them. My view is that you do have something to hide if you're being so secretive.
And we actually have a hearing on that right now at 1 o'clock.
Another hearing. We'll let you go in just a moment. Okay. The last time you were on the show, you said you virtually endorsed Mayor Bowser for re-election, and you said that Vince Gray should stay as a council on the council and be the chairman of the health committee and do great work there. Have you talked to Gray? We're in the petition gathering stage. Has he said whether he's running or not to you?
He has not said that to me, I can be honest with you. He has not said that. I actually feel like some competition might be a good idea, but he has not gotten in or said he's going to get
people in. Wanted, some people wanted you to run.
Well, I wonder if they still do
now. This is the problem.
Yeah, I'm trying to do my job here.
I know. You can, all right, well, we're going to let you go, and we have another guest. Thank you for coming in and taking all those hot questions about this.
And if you just
tuned
in, I think the news of the day is that Councilmember Grasso did not commit to running for mayor. He did not answer the question. Leave
Thanks,
it at
guys.
That.
Appreciate you having me.
Well, we're changing guests here. We want to go to another story in Maryland. Unbelievable politics occurring in Maryland with both Montgomery County and the public financing and term limits and the state Democratic race for mayor. There was a new poll information out from Goucher College. Martin, what were some of the findings?
Well, I think the big finding is that of all the Democrats running, and there's many and many big name contenders, it's a tight competition. I mean, Rashern Baker, the county executive over in Prince George's County, is leading, but not leading by a whole lot. The other outtake that's really interesting is that 47% of Marylanders, say they are leaning toward or will definitely vote to reelect Hogan. So that's, I mean, again, he's a Republican in a blue state. 47% is pretty good, but he's probably going to need a little bit more if he's going one-on-one against a Democrat. I mean, 47% is not going to do it.
And also, it's not specifically part of the poll, but in a state, a fairly moderate to liberal blue state, we have no statewide elected women in the office, and now all the candidates for governor so far have picked women to be their running mates.
Yeah, which is a good thing, because again, it's very easy. You know, it takes effort to think these things through and say, listen, if we want more women in office, we have to encourage them to run, we have to put them on tickets and that sort of stuff, and that takes effort from candidates like the folks running for governor. So good for them.
The tickets will all be set next week. I think the 27th is the deadline for putting your tickets together. Joining us in the studio now is David Iannucci. His title is too long. I'm just going to tell you he's the head of economic development in Prince George's County.
Good.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Thank you. Doesn't sound like a political position.
It's not.
Well, we'll see what we can do here on the politics side. Well, we want to talk about two things. Prince George's County is a terrific place where people live and work and do all the things, but it seems to have a stumbling block of being seen as economically progressive and growing, like Montgomery County and Fairfax and even the District of Columbia. Your county was shut out of the Amazon deal. You were not picked. You had a pretty good proposal for that. You weren't picked. What does it mean for Prince George's County? How do you rebound from that?
Well, the good news is that we've been on such a winning streak.
Oh, excuse me. I wanted to ask you first.
Yes, sir.
You've had a terrible situation this past week with the death of a police officer. I want you to, and I know Rashern Baker, you want to speak for him and the whole county.
Well, on behalf of Mr. Baker, Chief Zielinski, and all of the law enforcement community and the citizens of the county, we appreciate the wide support and the outpouring of emotional backup on that. It's been a terrible situation for the family and for the county overall. So thank you very much.
And the corporal was off duty and intervened in a domestic situation. It just goes to show the danger, the daily danger in being a police officer or any kind of first responder.
Every day they put their lives at risk for all of us, and so we're grateful for that, but just deeply sorry for this real tragedy.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't want to jump ahead of that. So now back to Amazon, the region, the district and Virginia in their running. What do you see happening in Prince George's County? It seems to be unfairly always the behind everybody else and maybe getting things, and we'll get to the FBI headquarters too, which is on the rocks at this moment. But anyway, what's the good news out of the Amazon bid?
Well, the good news for Prince George's County is we've been on such a winning streak, we really haven't had a chance to deal with these losses recently. Where Prince George's County for four consecutive quarters has led the state of Maryland, all 24 jurisdictions, in job growth. Out of the 347 largest counties, we're 21st in job growth in the United States, leading every county in the Washington metropolitan area.
Jobs. All kinds of jobs.
All kinds of jobs. So for the last 2 years overall, the county has been on a real hot streak when it comes to growth. Again, we are literally growing faster than every county in the state of Maryland and every county in the D.C. area. And we've come a long way from those really kind of difficult days at the beginning of Mr. Baker's administration. So we competed very hard for Amazon. Quite frankly, we were disappointed. We thought that we had an outstanding proposal. Everyone who has seen it has said that we were very powerful in terms of jobs, location. Amazon, in our debriefing, praised particularly the creativity of a project we put together in the College Park and the University mm-hmm. of Maryland. We tied a lot of our effort to the connection between the University of Maryland.
But they also said you don't have enough senior executives,
senior software development engineers. And that was the one thing that they pointed to.
But if they came to the Prince George's County, you couldn't keep you'd have to build a wall, if I could use somebody's phrase, to keep all those senior executives from coming into the county. That doesn't sound like a deficit.
Well, we frankly disagreed, although we're arguing with ourselves at that point. They've already made the decision. But we disagreed. We said, if 50,000 people are going to be hired by Amazon, the catchment area for that is going to be 50 or 75 miles. And within that region, Maryland as a state is very, very strong on technology workers. The D.C. area is strong on that. We know we have concentrations, particularly with the University of Maryland, Bowie State, and even our community college. So we disagreed on that, and we're convinced that we are a player on that. But Mr. Baker, we've all thrown our support for Montgomery County. We're part of this region.
He's running for governor. This is the last time we can mention his name.
Is it?
I think we've mentioned him three or four times already, but that's good. But it's an important part of his campaign, both as county executive and running for governor.
We all very much support the idea of the region will benefit from this. We believed from the beginning, Prince George's County, that Amazon was going to choose a metropolitan area where they thought they could find the workforce of the future. Their next 50,000 employees. And we're convinced that's still the case. We're disappointed that they didn't look at our sites as closely as we think they should have, but we gained from the experience. Prince George's County, again, leading the state of Maryland, leading the D.C. area. We're poised for future growth. We've got development going from north to south in the county.
You've got the room. You've got the transportation network. You've got
That's right. And the Baltimore Boulevard around College Park is one of our fastest growing areas. There's going to be $400 million project in Suitland. Our new hospital's under construction in the Largo area. That'll be part of literally a $1 billion development around there. New Carrollton is our metro station there, is going strong. Kaiser's building a new headquarters facility there.
So what is – yeah, go ahead, Martin.
So one question, and this I'm always curious about this, and I'm not in development, but I cover it occasionally. And I live in the district, but I live actually very close to the Prince George's County line, not far from Rhode Island Avenue, which is Route 1, heading out into College Park. And I've seen all the development along, at least when you get to College Park. The rest of Route 1 is a little bit different. But then it makes me think, like, and it's not just Prince George's County, lots of places love getting these massive projects, the HQ2s, the FBI buildings, those sorts of, you know, those things that bring the tens of thousands of jobs in one go to a specific location. But it seems like the thing that's tougher to unlock, and we can tie this to Route 1, is the smaller scale development. I mean, you're not, there's not a part of Route 1 that I can think of from Mount Rainier to College Park where you can just plop a new government facility and hope 10,000 people will go work there. So it seems like smaller scale things. So what can you do on a smaller scale to get like mom and pop businesses or spur some development along Route 1? Like Hyattsville is such a cute old historic downtown, but still has a lot of empty storefronts. Like what can the county do to help Hyattsville along?
People are often surprised when they go to the county. Oh, this is a great place.
And well, I'm not sure you've been in Hyattsville recently. Hyattsville is really booming around the Franklins, around Busboys and Poets.
True, but
The Whole Foods is a new location there. We have the first Whole Foods in Prichard's County.
Riverdale Park, I shop there often.
Very good. And a lot of, so we are, Route 1, really from Mount Rainier all the way up to the Beltway is really one of our hottest development corridors. And I would say the vacancy rate is very small. College Park is in the midst of a redevelopment project. We're working with major developers like Bizzuto for a downtown project in College Park. So we feel very much that we're creating opportunities for our small business community, particularly the minority businesses in the county. But at the same time, we're trying very hard to grow our tax base on the commercial side to bring more jobs so that our residents, two-thirds of our residents every day have to leave the county for their employment. We want to
coming into
jobs.
The district mostly, right?
Well, in the district, Northern Virginia, Montgomery County, they're getting on the Beltway every day, dealing with congestion and pollution and dealing with Metro. So we want to create jobs in the county. And the good news is we are the last county standing when it comes to transit-oriented development. We have 15 metro stations, and we have development opportunities in Greenbelt and in College Park and Largo and New Carrollton and Suitland. Camp Springs is where the Citizenship and Immigration Services is going to bring 3,700 jobs.
So you talk about jobs, just real quick, you talk about jobs, obviously folks in Prince George's County driving into Northern Virginia, the district for jobs and that sort of stuff, and it's true. Now, the other kind of trend I'm thinking, if you guys are noticing or planning around, is the fact that the district has gotten extremely expensive, and a lot of families are getting moved out. And now the joke is that the district's art, like the city's art district is technically Mount Rainier and Hyattsville and so that sort of stuff. Like Prince George's County has become the place where
I was just out there to look at the Marion Barry statue that's going to be unveiled. You know, that's the studio.
Right.
And you see all the houses there. Mount Rainier looks like a little Tacoma Park.
Arts
so have you guys,
district.
Have you guys thought about, with the gentrification that's happening in the district, is gentrifying people, lots of people out, families, can Prince George's County capitalize on that and say, listen, this is a great place to live. We've got nice little areas you can live. We've got good affordable housing. You know, this is a place that's on the up and up. Are you guys kind of trying to market that?
Well, you just gave our sales pitch. We lead the region when it comes to affordable housing. Crime is down to historic low levels. Our education system is improving. And we're working very hard, as you pointed out, to create jobs in the county so our residents don't have to travel long distances. So they will have places to shop in the Route 1 corridor. Suitland's going to have exciting development around there. Largo is going to be completely redeveloped into the urban town center of Prince George's County with a healthcare focus, including the county executive's office and the county administration moving from Upper Marlboro to Largo literally in about 2 weeks. So we see the development. You're right. We are absolutely focused on those small businesses, minority businesses, local businesses. But we particularly do want larger employers as well. That's why CIS is important. That's why the FBI was important. That's why Amazon would have been important. We've got Kaiser, Children's. These are new employers, company like 2U, going to be 2,000 jobs at 2U, a digital entertainment education company, right by the New Carrollton Metro Station.
Now that Martin has given the pitch for his county,
he did a great job on that.
There's still an image of the county as being that having two, mostly it's inside the Beltway, that's too poor, and that the crime is, although down now, is still too high. And we have an email from someone who says, I am a proud Prince George's resident. But why would any major high-tech company come to a county with our school system? The schools are having some issues with graduation, and that's a good question. What's the answer?
Well, in Prince George's County, we'll acknowledge, and I'm in economic development, that's my focus, that issues such as public safety and education are economic development factors there. And that's why under Mr. Baker, under this administration, we've worked so hard to reduce the crime rate to the point where it's in Reagan-era numbers. That's why we took, the county administration took over the school system to bring in new attention. The majority county dollars were going to the education system, yet the county administration had no control over it. So there have been new reforms. major changes. It's obviously still a work in progress, but the education system is improving. My own daughter is a product of Prince George's County education system. She goes to Eleanor Roosevelt High School right now, and she's getting outstanding education. So there are great opportunities for education in the county, but yes, we acknowledge there's still work to do.
Let's go briefly here on the FBI. Two other issues, two big businesses. And one, the FBI, the General Services Administration, threw a curveball at everybody and said, hey, we're not going to move after all. Virginia, never mind, your two sites, or one site I think it is, in right. Prince George's County, your sites, never mind, we're not moving. Do you think that's a dead idea? Do you think maybe politically that could come back to life later this year or next year based on how their elections go? And the fact that the FBI needs to consolidate 11,000 jobs, and they don't really want to send some of those jobs out of the area so they can go back downtown.
We're working on the assumption that it is still a real proposition, a real idea. We're working closely with Congressman Hoyer, Senator Cardin's office. Congress controls the purse strings, and I think one reporter told me that President Trump had managed to unify Democrats and Republicans on one issue finally. They all think this is a stupid decision. and if you
the
are,
FBI won't say publicly, but you know, they really need a place to do their job, and they can't really stay downtown. It's not as secure as they would like to have it, and it's a dead zone on Pennsylvania Avenue, and the city was really looking forward to redeveloping
right.
that to where people would actually go instead of hide behind barriers.
You know, 5 years ago, the GSA said the most expensive option was staying at the Hoover site and that it could never be built to meet security concerns. Suddenly, 5 years later, they pretend it's the
right
cheapest
across,
option.
It's right across the street from the Trump Hotel. Maybe the president wants to keep the FBI closer to him.
There's a lot of speculation of where this order came from. I'll tell you that when the county officials were briefed in December by the FBI and GSA on their plans, as recently as mid-December, they indicated that their preference was to start where they left off when it came to the final three sites.
Okay.
So something changed very quickly.
We're almost out of time.
Quick on the FBI. It would be a really big, secure facility. Like, how does that help spur development around it? Like, what's attractive about that?
Okay. It can't okay. work. I mean, we literally, from the experts, were saying you okay. cannot put 11,000 employees in a secure facility at that location. They okay. will not accomplish what they want in the consolidation. The FBI needs what the CIA has, NSA has.
Mr. Anuja, we're out of time. Quickly, are you still trying to keep the Redskins in your county?
They're an important a member of our corporate community. The citizens of the county are very proud that they're in the county.
Mr. Anuja, thank you for coming in. Martin, thanks for sitting in for me.
It was
our show today. I'm Tom Sherwood. Have a good evening.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Namdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.